From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Florida's Blue-Green Algae Task Force met again on Monday. Its five members are charged with finding ways to reduce nutrient pollution that fuels toxic cyanobacteria blooms and determine how best to allocate resources to speed up nutrient reductions in Lake Okeechobee and the downstream estuaries. Nutrients polluting Florida's water bodies are widely recognized as the main driver of harmful algal blooms. The task force has identified the primary sources as agricultural operations, wastewater treatment plants, on-site sewage disposal systems, and urban stormwater runoff. At Monday's meeting, task force members got one step closer to finalizing the recommendations, which will be presented to the governor and lawmakers before the 2020 legislative session. Joining me now to talk about that meeting and the overall task force process so far is Dr. Mike Parsons. He is professor of marine science at Florida Gulf Coast University and director of FGCU's Coastal Watershed Institute and Vester Field Station. Dr. Parsons, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Our conversation is pre-taped, so if you'd like to engage with us and our listeners, you can do so via social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So what's happened so far as far as things coming to the surface when it comes to priorities that will eventually be recommended by the task force?
Well, basically, if you look at our meetings we've had since in May and June, so on and so forth, we've talked about various subjects. So anything from the basin management action plans to best management practices to septic tanks to stormwater, so on and so forth. And so we took all of these subjects and the discussions we had about them and the recommendations we discussed at each of the meetings, and we put them into a document. So some portions of the document, you know, we're finished fairly early on because we had those discussions back in June or whatnot. But in September, when we had the two-day meeting in Naples, that was the first time we really discussed the public health and the stormwater portion of potential nutrient sources and impacts of blue-green algae. And so that took a little bit more discussion, and that's really where our timeline got compressed here near the end of the process.
When we talk about stormwater, are we talking about stuff washing off of lawns and golf courses into drainage systems? Are we talking about stormwater aerosolized thing that go out over the waterways and pour down?
This is mainly the drainage systems into retention ponds and, you know, various ditches, if you will. And when they're put into place, they're designed to basically hold water for a certain amount of time in some cases and reduce nutrients by a certain amount. And so a lot of it is they're presumed to basically perform at a certain level. So since we have a nutrient crisis, if you will, and we need to reduce our nutrient inputs, we feel that it really shouldn't be presumed. We should actually make measurements and see if they are reducing the nutrients like on paper they're supposed to be doing.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. So I'm wondering, is there anything that is an obvious fix, kind of like a low-hanging fruit kind of a situation? Anything that sticks out as, well, obviously this is a thing we have to do?
Well, I think the first step in this, one of the DEP representatives, Department of Environmental Protection, he had a great line that I've been using ever since, and that was, the first thing we need to do is put the system on a diet. And the idea is we need to reduce the nutrient inputs into the waterways. And if I just talk about Lake Okeechobee for now and then into Lake Okeechobee. So the real first step we need there is to understand, you know, how nutrients are getting into the system, what nutrient reduction steps have already been taken in terms of their effectiveness. And so the real issue is that actions have been taken for many years, but there's not an easy way or an established way to assess how effective these different methods are. And so, you know, a critical first step really is assessing what actions have been taken already. If they are effective, great. Then we can move forward and take more steps. If some of them are not effective, can we make them effective, or do we have to scrap those plans or those activities and move in a different direction? So it's basically really assessing where we're at right now. And so when you look at several of our recommendations, they're really geared towards getting some solid data on where we are right now. What are the nutrient inputs? From where are there hotspots? What actions have been taken already to reduce these nutrient inputs? Are they effective? How many nutrients are they reducing? And then move forward from that.
It sounds like a much more thorough investigation of what's been done and what works with what has been done, and seeing whether or not it's worth continuing to do and then moving forward, as opposed to what we kind of saw last year during legislative session, where things were kind of hotly politicized because things were really fresh in everybody's mind.
Right.
And we were like, okay, everybody needs to get off septic, and septic's terrible. And it was, people were kind of rushing to try to do things. It's interesting to look at all these different contributors, because every time we talk, there it's hard to identify all the things that contribute to these nutrients, and picking out which one's the easiest or the most cost effective or most effective overall to fix and work on.
Right. And then, and another part of it is, when you look at a septic system or a septic tank, it was really designed for two things. One is to break down the organic matter, the waste, and, you know, have the bacteria process it. But the bacteria process it in the nutrients. So the organic matter is basically broken down back into the nutrients. Septic tanks were never designed to remove nutrients. So we can't expect them to do something they weren't designed to do. But we need to get a handle on what is their nutrient footprint.
Mm-hmm.
And if in some areas it might be a big footprint. In other areas it might not be big enough to really worry about. And so if it is a big enough footprint, what steps, what actions can be taken to reduce their nutrient footprint? And it's a similar thing with the best management practices in agriculture. They're not designed to reduce nutrients. They're designed how to best water and use fertilizer in certain kinds of soils, certain types of fields in terms of their slope and size, and what crops you want to raise. So if we're looking at agriculture as being a major source of nutrients, and we're finger pointing at best management practices, people have to realize they were not designed to reduce nutrients.
Is there any
one recommendation is, well, why don't we design them to reduce nutrients?
That was my next question. Is it possible that best management practices can include how to best not pollute things?
Yeah, I think, you know, and the farmers don't want fertilizer to run off into the water any more than someone else does. You may as well take $10 bills and just throw it into the stream or the river,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so it's a waste of money. So, of course, they would want to keep the fertilizers on their fields so that the plants can take up those nutrients and grow faster, get better yields, you know, and ultimately that'll be more income. So, yeah, I think everybody's on the same page on that. But then the question is like, well, okay, how easy or hard is it going to be to reduce that nutrient runoff into a tributary and Kissimmee River, Lake Okeechobee, or whatnot? And so that's where the best management practices. That's one recommendation would be for the agricultural best management practices to look into that, because there are data available. And whether or not it's 100% applicable to the farmlands, let's say north of Lake Okeechobee, some of these may have been, for example, designed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture for Iowa. Would they be applicable in Florida? Maybe not. So that's where some tweaking might need to be put in play.
And then that leads me to ask about the legacy nutrients, and I'm wondering how those can fit into this equation. Is this task force looking at ways to mitigate the, apparently, I guess, several feet of nutrients that are at the bottom of Lake Okeechobee?
Yeah, so that kind of goes back to my the quote that we need to put the system on a diet.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't get rid of that sludge until you reduce the nutrients coming into the system. So that's the diet,
mm-hmm.
right? So less caloric intake, and then you'll start burning the fat off. So less nutrient inputs, then you'll start working through that sludge. It can occur naturally, but it's going to take a long, long time based on data currently available. So that's where maybe some of these innovative technologies come into play that we're also recommending that the state support some initiatives. And so would there be technologies that could help farmers keep nutrients from getting into the water? Or once nutrients are in the water, is there a way to remove them before they get into Lake Okeechobee? Or once they're in Lake Okeechobee, is there a way to remove them or clean up the sludge? And so that's where some of that technology or some of those actions would come into play. And I think that's a little bit more long-term, not meaning we have to wait to do it, but it's going to take longer to see a response or see a positive impact. Mm-hmm. But it's just like dieting. You know, if I say I started my diet this morning, it's not like I'm going to lose 10 pounds by the afternoon.
But we would like to, wouldn't we?
Oh, we would like to. But it's a similar process. And, you know, the folks around Chesapeake Bay have been dealing with this for decades in terms of, you know, multi-state effort, reducing the nitrogen inputs into the Chesapeake Bay to try to basically restore and recover the ecosystems there. And it takes time. It takes time before you see a response.
Yeah, just like dieting. So speaking of dieting, on the human health side of things, you mentioned earlier that was one of the things that had been discussed. The Department of Health was largely silent during last year's blue-green algae outbreak. What kind of things are you talking about in regards to that as far as any kind of research and recommendations?
There really were two issues that we talked about, and one of them also involved DEP, Department of Environmental Protection. So basically, the DEP collects the water samples and analyzes them for toxins. So they look at the algal content and they look at the toxin content. Then they pass that information on to Department of Health and discuss it, and you'll have various advisories, and they have new signage, Department of Health does, on the advisories where you can say, you know, one sign, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it's like warning there are cyanobacteria in the water. And then the other one is toxins have been measured here. So avoid getting in the water. So what the premise really is and the strategy is that if you see blue-green waters, you see that scum on the water or mat of algae on the surface, if you smell that sewage-type smell, just don't go in the water and keep your pets away from the water. Mm-hmm. And that's generally the criteria that's used is, you know, and I don't know if they came up with a phrase for it, but it's, you know, there could be a slogan, whereas if you see a bloom, you know, this isn't the slogan, but if you see the bloom, don't go in. You know, it's basically what it comes down to.
But what about the concerns about breathing it in?
That is so, and obviously I do work on that, but that is so, I guess, new and unknown mm-hmm. that we can't even begin discussions of it. And so, you know, what we do know based on our past conversations are that we can measure the toxins in the air, and we know people are being exposed to it, but we have no idea on what that exposure means. Mm-hmm. And we just don't have the data for it. And so I know the CDC was looking into conducting some more projects and try to get a better handle of exposure. Department of Health put out a request for proposals for universities and their partners to study airborne toxins to get a better handle on what risk these represent. So there are steps being taken, but, you know, it took a little while to get the funding set up. Mm-hmm. The CDC probably needs more funding to conduct their study. And then to, you know, put out the request for proposals, the people need to write the proposals, the proposals need to be reviewed, Department of Health needs to choose which projects they want to fund, then the money needs to come in, then you can start the project. So it takes a bit of time. And, you know, basically it involves doing the air sampling, doing the water sampling, looking for toxins, and then people sample, you know, look at blood samples, look at nasal swabs, maybe mouth oral swabs, urine samples, blood samples.
And having actual data on health impacts as opposed to anecdotal.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do people feel, you know, basically. So, you know, there's a cyanobacteria bloom in the area. You know, doing a survey, basically. And I don't know what would be on the survey, but you'd ask them basic questions about their well-being, their health, so on and so forth. Some people noticed coughs before. Some people said they may have felt nauseous. That could have been that sewage smell and the hydrogen sulfide. But
yeah, that can make you feel kind nauseous.
And so just getting a sense of what the exposure is.
Exactly.
Some groups are looking at liver enzymes. And mm-hmm. so the idea there would be that microcystins, which is the main toxin produced by the microcystis blue-green algae, that was the one that was blooming last year and back in 2016 over on the East Coast, it's a liver toxin. It's a hepatotoxin. So by looking at liver enzyme activity, you might get a sense of, all right, is the liver being exposed to the toxins and reacting to it? Mm-hmm. So there's other measures that we can look at as well. But that, you know, that'll take time because you basically need to sample people over time and what their exposure is and just in their daily activities. You know, you can't say, okay, go jump around and swim in the scummy water. And so it's more what would people normally be exposed to.
So this task force, are you tasked with coming up with recommendations for the upcoming legislative session?
Yes.
So how many more meetings do you think you're going to be having between now and I think it's January, right?
I think we're basically done with our recommendation.
Oh, okay.
And so yesterday we had a meeting in Gainesville. And so on Friday, let me take a step back. So we were supposed to meet in August in Gainesville to discuss the public health and the stormwater issues. But because of Hurricane Dorian, we canceled the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
We rescheduled the meeting for September. But that was also when we were supposed to finalize our recommendations. So we did a two-day meeting in Naples then. But the second day of the meeting was to go over our draft recommendations. And there was really only 8 to 12 hours of public comment.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a rushed process. But we're under a pretty tight deadline to get this to the governor and to the DEP. So they can, you know, discuss it with the committees, legislative committees. But realizing that we dealt with a compressed timeline in September, we scheduled another meeting. So it was a meeting that was not anticipated for yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And that was to give the public more time to look at the document, get some more public comment, and allow the task force to go through it one more time. And just make sure everything is accurate, that it conveyed the task force consensus, basically, on items. And so some minor edits, Tom Frazier, Chief Science Officer for Florida, he's doing some final edits on it right now. And I'm assuming that this is the finished document that will go to the governor. Whether or not we ask for more public comment, I know we'll post it, but I don't think we'll be taking any further action on it. We just need to start moving forward. And I think people need to realize that this document is our first step mm-hmm. in the process. It's not the task force last step. This is the first step.
Do you feel satisfied with it?
Yeah, I think it's a good document. I think our recommendations are strong. I think they're solid. They are a little broad. We're basically looking at it from a 10,000-foot level. But that being said, they can have some, they can really, have some big impacts. If our recommendation that agricultural management practices should also address nutrient reductions, if that actually gets put in place, that could have a huge impact on the nutrient inputs coming into the system.
So
just that one sentence could actually make a big difference.
Putting Florida on a diet?
Exactly.
Nutrient diet.
Or Lake Okeechobee. I think it's more fitting Lake Okeechobee. Because we still need to use the fertilizers for the agricultural crops. When you get in the golf courses, or you get in the people's lawns and things like that, that's more of a luxury use of fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, food prices aren't going to go up. People aren't going to starve. And it's not going to affect the food supply. You know, your lawn maybe won't be quite as green, or you might have to use a different iron or different fairway wood if the fertilizer isn't being used as much
on
the golf course. So a little bit of a different scenario. But those fertilizer inputs are, can be significant in some areas too, the non-agricultural ones.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Sure, no problem.
It's been great talking with you again, and congratulations again on being part of this task force. So
I'm not sure if it's a blessing or a curse, but thank you very much.
Well, I was wondering, the other thing I was going to ask you, like, I know you don't get to go into dreamland territory very often as a scientist that's looking to have studies funded and data actually come in. If you could, what would be your dream recommendation? Hey, state of Florida, this is what I think we need to do.
Well, I think the final paragraph of our document, or the final section, I should say, I think that really captures what I think should be, you know, a significant step, a significant action, and probably one of our first steps. And that really is getting the data to see how effective our current practices are and see where the problems are so we can, you know, really address it. Because we know, you know, frankly, we know that nutrient reduction actions have been put in place. On paper, they're in place, saying something on the order of 20% reduction. But when you look at the data, there is no reduction.
Mm.
So it's not working.
Yeah, something's not working there.
Yeah, so we need to assess what's not working and then fix it. So I think it's a two-step: fund or reallocate resources so we can monitor to do that assessment, and then provide the funding so we can make the fixes, whatever improvements, infrastructure, or whatnot to reduce those nutrient outputs.
That was Dr. Mike Parsons. He's a professor of marine science at Florida Gulf Coast University and director of FGCU's Coastal Watershed Institute and Vester Field Station. You can read the most recent Blue-Green Algae Task Force draft consensus document number 1 on our website, gulfcoastlive.org.